The voices were muffled. The sounds of movement made up of bumps and scuffles. And there was music, terribly soft, almost inaudible, tinny and old, like music from a bygone era playing on a gramophone, its scratchy warblings coming from a yawning horn above a cranked-up turntable. It didn't sound like something any of the kids would listen to, but still. He got out of bed, careful not to wake Carmen, and went down the hall in his undershorts. The sounds grew closer. He stopped and listened and realized they were coming from downstairs. Quiet voices, soft, mournful music. Obviously, there was a gathering of some sort taking place down there. Al suspected Jason was involved somehow. In fact, it was probably his idea to sneak a bunch of kids into the house from the beginning. But why were they listening to that music? Stepping carefully in the dark, he started down the stairs but stopped halfway down. There was no light coming from down there. No light at all. It was as dark as the rest of the house. Al frowned, listened some more. He could still hear the voices and the music, still heard the sounds of feet moving over the floor. He took the remaining steps cautiously, although he wasn't quite sure why. In the bedroom below, he heard the boy's steady, sleepy breathing, and suddenly, nothing else. There was only the breathing and the darkness. The voices and music had stopped. Al opened one of the French doors and leaned into the next room. The empty darkness was silent but cold. Al stepped all the way into the next room, squinting, in disbelief. It was so cold in that room that he was pretty sure that if it weren't so dark, he'd be able to see his breath. It was like a meat locker. Concerned that a window might have been left open, he took a few more steps into the room, then stopped, realizing that even if a window was open, it wasn't that cold outside. Then he suddenly realized that the cold was gone. The room had returned to a normal temperature, but Al's skin crawled with goosebumps anyway. He thought about it a moment, wondered how it could have happened, then decided he didn't want to know and backed out of the room. He listened again to the boys breathing. Yes, they were asleep, there was no doubt about that. Stephen was even snoring quietly, but a genuine snore, not a silly one that a kid might fake at the last minute to keep from being caught awake by a parent. When he got back to bed, Al found Carmen awake. She asked him what was the matter, and he told her to go back to sleep. Al, however, did not sleep. Instead, he lay in bed listening for the voices and music again, but he did not hear them. The following night, he was awakened again, this time by movement. His eyes snapped open wide and stared into the darkness as the bed vibrated. It didn't shake. It didn't jerk. It vibrated. Slowly, his eyes closed as he decided it was probably nothing more than the refrigerator coming on in the upstairs apartment. Carmen had mentioned to him that a family would be moving in upstairs, but his eyes snapped open again when he realized that they wouldn't be moving in for another week. The upstairs apartment was empty. There was no refrigerator up there. He stared at the ceiling as the bed continued to vibrate, its movement humming through him, oozing through his muscles and coiling around his bones. Al got up and went to the living room, turning on lights as he walked, his hands trembling. He watched television for a while, smoked, had a couple of beers, and then, warily, returned to the bedroom. He sat on the edge of the bed. The vibrating had stopped. Although he was exhausted from the sleepless night before, he was unable to doze off for a while. He lay there waiting for the vibrating to continue. It did not. Finally, Al slipped away and slept late into Sunday morning. Now he lay awake once again, staring at talking heads with no voices on the television, drinking a beer and filling the dark room with smoke. There was a good chance that he would not have given either incident much thought, if it weren't for Stephen. If it weren't for the things Stephen had said he'd seen and heard, the things he'd said about the house. There was something else, too. Something Al hadn't thought about in years. In fact, he'd thought he'd forgotten about it entirely, which would have been fine with him. It had happened years ago, when he was in the service. He'd seen something back then that had given him nightmares for the longest time. In fact, he still had one now and then, until he'd seen that thing. He'd laughed at the supernatural, and his laughter had been genuine. Since then, he'd continued laughing, but nervously and without as much conviction as before. He'd told no one of what he'd seen back then, not even Carmen. He wasn't sure he ever would. But what had happened at home last weekend had brought it to mind, and had reminded him that he was no longer closed to the notion of things that go bump in the night. His transfer would go through soon, and he would be able to move to Connecticut to stay with his family. He missed Carmen and the kids, and was looking forward to being with them for more than just weekend visits. But Al wasn't at all sure he was looking forward to moving into that house. 10. Making a Deal. Stephen knew his parents would not approve of the music he and Jason were listening to in Stephen's bedroom, but he realized that he didn't care. That had not always been the case. There was a time, very recently in fact, although it seemed like ages ago, when their approval had meant something to him, and the mere knowledge of their disapproval would have been enough to make him think twice about lying there on his bed listening to Ozzy Osbourne's shrieking voice. But now Stephen found himself feeling a certain amount of resentment toward Carmen and Al, enough to make him careless of what they might think. Al's transfer had gone through, and he'd been home for the better part of a week now, so there were two people around all the time who didn't believe him, who didn't even seem to trust him. He resented them for that disbelief, as well as for their eagerness to blame him for every little thing that went wrong in the house. They blamed him when the other kids got scared, and they blamed him whenever something in the house disappeared or was misplaced. He wondered what he'd be blamed for next, but he didn't care. If they didn't care about what he thought, he would no longer care about what they thought.
"So, who would you rather sleep with?" Jason said. "Madonna or Joan Jett?"
He was lying on Michael's bed in the same position in which Stephen was lying on his own, face up, ankles crossed, hands locked behind his head with elbows jutting out at each side. The day was coming to an end outside, and the fading light of early evening shone through the windows. In spite of that, every light in the room was on. Stephen did that everywhere he went in the house now. He didn't like to be in any room that was not well lit.
"I don't know," Stephen said thoughtfully. "Which one's worth the most money?"
"What difference does that make? They're both hot."
"Yeah, but after I've had them, they'll be so grateful they'll want to shower me with expensive gifts and lots of cash. So I want the one that's got the most."
Concealed laughter was hidden in Stephen's voice. Jason tossed his head back and laughed, then said,
"You're so full of shit, your ears stink."
Then he laughed some more before adding, "Madonna's got bigger boobs."
"Think so?"
"Oh, yeah, yeah, I know so. Show you."
He sat up and leaned down to get a brown paper bag on the floor beside the bed. It was full of rock magazines he'd brought over with him that he and Stephen hadn't looked through yet. He dumped the bag on the bed and began searching through the stack for the one he wanted. Stephen liked Jason for a number of reasons, among them the fact that, unlike the only people he'd been able to hang around with back in Hurleyville, he was cool. Back home, being in all those damned special education classes had kept him from being accepted by the popular kids at school. He'd ended up spending his time with the other boneheads in those classes while the kids he really wanted to be with had spent their time picking on him, laughing at him, and calling him names. Well, maybe Jason wasn't what they would consider cool, but he was a good friend to Stephen, and he had lots of cool things, like all those rock magazines he bought every month, a great collection of tapes, a boombox to play them on, and, or so he claimed, a bunch of pornography. Although Stephen had seen very little of it because, understandably, Jason had to be careful about flashing it around. He liked some of the same music Stephen liked, pop music mostly, but it introduced him to a lot of stuff Stephen hadn't listened to in the past, because he knew how much his parents disliked it. But what Stephen liked most was that Jason believed him when he talked about the things that had been happening. Not only did he believe Stephen, he accepted the stories to be true as nonchalantly as one might accept a newspaper headline to be true. He hadn't shown a flicker of doubt.
Yeah, here it is,
Jason said, holding one of the magazines open. It was a back issue of Rock Scene, as he got up and went to Stephen's bed. Stephen sat up and looked down at the picture Jason indicated, a shot of Joan Jett on stage at a concert, wearing a very tiny black bikini.
See?
Jason said.
Great bod, but flat as a board.
Yeah, but how much money does she have?
Stephen said, and they both laughed until... Jason's laughter stopped, as if he'd choked on it. Stephen looked up to see Jason's eyes opening wider than seemed possible, as they stared to Jason's right. His mouth opened and closed several times, but he made no sound, just dropped the magazine onto Stephen's lap as his face lost some of its color. Following the direction of Jason's eyes, Stephen's gaze fell on the French doors and on the old man who stood beyond them. Stephen kicked his legs and tumbled clumsily off the bed until he was on his feet, then spun around toward the French doors. Both boys stood frozen in place for a long time, staring. The man's skin was white. It wasn't clown white or sheet white, or even merely pale. It was the white of skin that had been drained of blood, of life, a sick, milky, splotchy white. The skin was wrinkled beyond the effects of old age, unnaturally wrinkled and flabby, as if nothing lay between it and the bones beneath. What was left of his white hair was stringy and hung in thin patches to varying lengths. He wore a dark suit that appeared old in both style and condition. It looked ragged and tattered, even dirty. The white hands that dangled from the sleeves were gnarled, and long, thick nails curved downward over the fingertips. The old man did not move, just faced the boys. He would have been staring at them, had there been anything besides empty, glassy white orbs in his eye sockets. Jason ran first, but Stephen wasn't far behind him. They quickened their pace as they rushed past the French doors, then thumped loudly up the stairs, leaving the music playing in the room behind them. They were halfway down the hall when Carmen stepped out of the dining room and snapped.
Why do you always have to run up those damned stairs? How many times have I told you?
She stopped when she got a good look at their faces and saw that they were gasping from fear rather than exertion. Stephen pointed back down the hall and said,
There was a... We saw a man...
Oh, God. Stephen, not again.
For a moment she sounded very weary, as if Stephen had told her she was going to have to take another in an exhausting series of long uphill runs. Then she sounded angry.
Damn it, Stephen. This is getting really old, and I'm...
No, we did,
Jason insisted.
There was an old man down there just standing there and staring at us.
She just looked at them, from Stephen to Jason and back again, silent and stern. Then she said,
It's a good thing Al's not here, Stephen.
Where is he?
At the grocery store. He's really getting sick of this business of you seeing people in your room, and so am I. You're liable to get your butt grounded if you keep...
But it's not just me,
Stephen insisted, frustrated.
No, Mrs. Snedeker, it's not,
Jason added.
I saw the guy, too. I saw the guy first.
Carmen's shoulders sagged as she let out a long sigh.
Okay, let's go.
She led the way down the stairs. As the boys followed, Stephen muttered,
Here we go again. Nothing there, making it up, stop lying.
Then he looked at Jason and rolled his eyes. Carmen faced the boys at the foot of the stairs, unable to keep herself from wincing at the sounds coming from Jason's boombox on the nightstand between the beds.
Okay. Where were you? What were you doing?
We were on the beds,
Stephen said.
And this, music was playing?
They nodded.
We were looking at rock magazines,
Jason said. Carmen glanced distastefully at the magazine on the bed, open to a mostly naked, angry-looking woman. She pushed the magazine aside and sat on Stephen's bed.
Okay,
she said.
Go upstairs. Go outside if you want. I don't care. Just go.
Stephen asked.
What are you gonna...
Just go.
She sounded irritable enough for them to know better than to stick around asking questions. When they were gone, Carmen stared at the French doors.
Okay, Carm,
she breathed, the words barely audible.
What the hell are you doing?
Although it was difficult to think with the rancid sounds pounding out of the speakers behind her, she decided she was calling Stephen's bluff. She'd sit on that bed and watch and wait and see what she could see. The conditions were exactly the same as those under which the boys claimed to have seen this old man. She was giving herself a chance to see him, too. That was all. Her inner voice spoke up then, shattering her sense of self-satisfaction, of self-security. "Giving yourself a chance to see him," it whispered. "Don't you mean you're giving it a chance to finally show itself? Don't you mean you're looking for whatever it is that's been moving things, taking things? Talking to you in a familiar voice from an empty room? Of course that's what you're doing, whether you admit it or not." Carmen shook her head sharply, as if to rid it of the gnawing voice. She leaned forward, elbows on her knees, chin on her knuckles, and continued to stare at the French doors, waiting. The music was truly awful, and, as she listened to the lyrics, she decided she'd have to have a word with Stephen about what music did and did not get played under this roof. As she waited, Carmen thought. No matter how she tried to hold her wandering thoughts in check, they went back to her inner voice, to the things that had been happening to her in the house, and for a moment, she thought she heard the sound of cautious movement from some other part of the basement. She sat up straight, her hands clutching together between her knees as she listened. Silence, except for the awful music. Then the song, if it could be called that, ended, and a moment later, another began. Was that more movement Carmen had heard in the brief silence? Was it moving closer? Or was it just your imagination? Her inner voice muttered. She suddenly felt as if her skin were shriveling around her bones. The hair at the base of her skull bristled. Although Carmen tried to listen for the sounds she'd thought she'd heard deeper in the basement, she tried to listen hard. She could not bring herself to stay there a moment longer and bolted from the bed. Halfway up the stairs, she tried to slow her hurried pace and calm her rapid breathing. Once she was in the hall, she had returned to what she hoped was her normal appearance, although inside, she still felt icy, unsteady, and afraid. But afraid of what?
"Where have you been?"
Al asked from the kitchen. His voice startled her. She hadn't heard him come in. She wasn't even sure how long she'd been down there, and as a result, had a silly, almost girlish feeling of guilt. As if she'd been caught doing something she shouldn't.
"Downstairs."
She went in the kitchen and found him loading the refrigerator with the groceries he'd gone to get.
"What's the matter with Stephen and Jason? I found them sitting on the front steps looking, I don't know, like they got into trouble or something."
"Oh, really?" "Well, they came running up the stairs earlier saying they'd seen a ghost. Another ghost, I should say."
"Oh, shit."
Al opened a bottle, closed the refrigerator, and took a couple gulps. When he looked at Carmen, his face was dark. He was wearing his half-angry, half-fed-up expression.
"Well, that's it," he said, leaving the kitchen. "That's the last of it."
He went out the front door and said firmly,
"Okay, Jason, I think it's time for you to go home for tonight."
The boy's head snapped up to look at him. Stephen said,
"But his parents are—"
"I'm sorry, but Jason's gonna have to go home."
"Can I get my stuff out of Stephen's room?"
"Sure."
Carmen stood at the top of the stairs while Al went down with the boys and waited as Jason got his things together, said goodbye, and left. Then Al pointed a finger at Stephen and said,
"No more ghosts, you understand me? We've had enough. No more voices, no more people in your room, that's it, it's finished. One more word about any of that stuff and you're going to be sorry. And we'll start with you staying down here for the rest of the night. No TV, no music, and no more of that crap I heard playing down here a little while ago, you got it? I don't want that trash in this house. You can go from here to the bathroom and back, that's it. I don't want to hear another word out of you till tomorrow. And turn off some of these damned lights, every light in the room is on. You start running up the bill and you could pay for it."
Al started up the stairs and Carmen expected Stephen to say something, to protest, to call up to him. The room downstairs was silent, though. Al took another swallow of beer as he walked by her.
"Don't you think that was a little too much, Al?"
"Why too much? You mean you're not getting sick of it? What else are we going to do, encourage him? Next time, he gets something worse. He gets grounded, or he can't watch the television, or use the phone, or something. I've had all I can take of this Twilight Zone shit."
Then Al went into the living room and turned on the television. Stephanie was in the backyard with Peter, and Michael was down the street playing with a friend. It was time to call them in. But first, she wanted to have a word with Stephen. She felt somewhat responsible for the tongue-lashing he'd gotten because she'd told Al about what he and Jason had seen. Of course, she hadn't and wouldn't tell Al about her little experiment afterward, about how she sat in the room waiting to see what she could see. Downstairs, she found Stephen lying on his bed, staring at the ceiling with his hands locked behind his head. She sat on the edge of his bed and said,
"Sorry about the outburst, but I think..."
"I don't give a shit what you think,"
Stephen said through clenched teeth without looking at her. Carmen gasped and stood up.
"Don't you ever talk to me that way again, or I'll slap your mouth halfway around your head, young man."
Very quietly, jaw still locked, he said,
"You don't care what I think. I don't care what you think. You don't want to hear what I have to say. I don't want to hear what you have to say."
Carmen's voice trembled when she spoke again.
"Whatever's wrong with you had better be gone by morning, Stephen. I mean it. That kind of behavior just doesn't cut it around here, so you'd better get over feeling sorry for yourself or whatever the hell you're doing right now. You might be a teenager, but you're still not too old to get your ass whipped."
She spun around and stomped upstairs to bring the other kids inside. When she was gone, Stephen undressed for bed. He still hadn't turned the lights off in his room. The darkness outside the window was now complete. No sunlight remained. Turning those lights off would let some of that darkness inside, and Stephen did not want to do that. Instead, he got into bed with the room fully lit. Even the bedside lamps were on. He turned onto his side and tried to relax, although he knew he would be unable to sleep for a while. He was too upset. So upset, in fact, that he was experiencing feelings he'd never known before. He wanted to break something, to pick something up and just smash it against the wall with all his might. His frustration was a vicious congestion in his chest that seemed to seep between his ribs and press against muscle and flesh. He closed his eyes tightly, blocking out the light, and pressed his head into the pillow.
"Stephen."
His eyes snapped open. He was alone in the room.
"Stephen, are you ready?"
the voice asked, ever so quietly. He didn't move for a while, just waited for it to continue. When it didn't, he opened his mouth, took a moment to ask himself if he was sure he wanted to do this, then said,
"Yes,
that's my boy.
If, only if you'll leave me alone. I'll,
he sat up a little.
"I'll do whatever you want, if you'll just leave me alone. Deal?"
That familiar chuckle, like ice cubes clattering over glass.
"Very good. Very good. It's a deal, my boy."
"It's a deal. So, you'll leave me alone?"
"You will have to hold up your end of the bargain first. You will have to do whatever I want, just as you said. Then, we'll see."
Stephen realized someone was coming down the stairs and quickly dropped back onto the mattress.
"You talking to somebody?"
Michael asked.
"Uh-uh."
Stephen covered half his face with the sheet, afraid the lie would show.
"I thought I heard you talking down here. I said no."
"Okay, okay.
Mom and Dad say I'm supposed to make sure the lights are off down here. Most of them, anyway."
Stephen thought about that a moment, pictured the room dimmer, even completely dark. For the first time since the move, the idea of darkness was not as frightening. Even a little comforting.
"Yeah,"
he said.
"Go ahead. Leave one of them on, though. You okay, Stephen?"
He suddenly found Michael annoying. He wanted to think, to go over what had just happened, but his brother wouldn't shut up. As he turned over on his belly and pulled the sheet up further, he growled,
"Yes, I'm okay, damn it. What's the matter with you?"
When Michael spoke again, he sounded hurt.
Nothing. Just asked.
His footsteps started up the stairs.
"I'll be back in a little while."
But Stephen did not respond. He lay in bed, wide awake, thinking about what he had done, wondering what kind of deal he had just made.
And with whom?
11. Changes. The changes that took place in the Snedeker family over the following months were very subtle, but not so subtle as to go unnoticed by Al and Carmen. They were, with the exception of the changes in Stephen's behavior, simply not discussed. Their lives went on as they always had, with the usual problems and the usual highlights. They went to church every Sunday, attended church functions and school functions on weeknights, occasionally rented a video to watch. If there appeared to be anything different about them on the outside, it was only that they seemed to settle into their new home and were finally feeling comfortable. The changes were not, however, exterior. They could not be seen by unfamiliar eyes. They were hardly visible to familiar ones. They were taking place under the skin, growing slowly, spreading like the cancer that had afflicted Stephen, but doing so without attention, without treatment of any kind. Without knowing the other was doing the same, Al and Carmen individually fought to cling to that stable exterior while trying to ignore little things that continued to happen all around them. Silly things that, taken one at a time, would be insignificant at best. But together. Together these incidents formed a pattern that Al and Carmen did not want to know about or even be aware of. So they fought to ignore it, and held even tighter to that normal, clean exterior they had built for themselves. And all the while, Stephen's behavior and personality changed. Later, Al and Carmen would say it had been instantaneous, but that was only because the initial changes were so gradual, so subtle, that when the transformation was complete, it caught them completely off guard. There were many things that during the next several months would catch them off guard.
Things seem to be going well for you guys,
Tanya said to Carmen one day while changing a messy diaper. Carmen was on the sofa drinking a diet cola and enjoying the sound of the baby's coos and burbles.
What do you mean? Oh, well, you said Stephen's better and...
No.
I said his cancer seems to have gone into remission. That doesn't mean it won't come back, it just means he's okay for now.
We're thankful for that, though, and we've put it in God's hands.
Yeah, but that's better than before, right? So Stephen's better for now. You seem, you seem more at ease, I guess. Like you're not so tense and anxious as you were before. Of course, I suppose you had a lot to be anxious about, what with the move and Stephen's cancer. You just seem happier, I guess. That makes sense?
Yeah, I suppose so,
Carmen said, although she was frowning. That was, of course, the effect she'd been trying for. She just hadn't realized she'd succeeded.
Be right back, Tanya said, taking the baby in her arms. I'm going to go put her down for a while.
Carmen nodded absently, then returned to her thoughts. She certainly hadn't felt happy or at ease. In fact, there were days when, if she allowed herself, she questioned her sanity, wondered if maybe the stress of Stephen's illness and the sudden move had caused some sort of delayed reaction, a nervous breakdown, perhaps. Sometimes, when she was alone in the house, walking from one room to another, she spotted movement in the corner of her eye, a flash of gray that darted from one piece of furniture to another. At first, she thought it was Willie. They usually kept him locked downstairs, but occasionally he weaseled his way up to the living room and wiggled around, playing hide-and-seek with them. But he was always locked up when she saw this blurred movement to her right or left. When she investigated it, there was never anything there. Twice she'd stood in the kitchen with her back to the refrigerator, washing dishes one time, chopping vegetables another, when she'd felt a wave of ice-cold air hit her back, as if the refrigerator door had swung open. But when she turned around, it was closed. The cold faded quickly until it seemed as if the drop in temperature had never occurred, if indeed it had. Also, twice she'd awakened to find the bed vibrating, almost as if it were one of those tacky motel beds, and someone had dropped a quarter in the slot. But without a sound. Beside her, Al had slept soundly. She'd gotten up both times, had a cigarette, gone to the bathroom, and when she'd returned, the vibrating had stopped. Each time something happened, movements, vibrations, the kitchen floor bleeding, or a voice or two she'd thought she'd heard when she knew no one else was in the house, she thought of Stephen. She thought, of course, of the things he'd said about the house, The things he'd supposedly seen, but she also thought of what had become of him since they'd moved into the house. First, there had been his fear of going downstairs. That had been very unlike Stephen, who, in spite of the treatment he'd received from his peers at school, had managed to remain an outgoing, even aggressive boy who had shown fear only when fear was sensible, not when there was nothing of which to be afraid. But lately, something else seemed to be happening. It was nothing physical, not like the result of his cobalt treatments. Instead, this was a change in his personality. Her first exposure to it was when he'd snapped at her while lying in his bed that night. "I don't give a shit what you think," he'd said, and his words had cut into her like rusty blades. He'd never said such a thing to her before, and it had hurt. The hurt had come out as anger, although she'd wanted to hunker down beside his bed in tears and ask, "Why would you talk like that to me, honey? Why?" But that had only been the beginning. He'd become very quiet after that. He seemed anxious to separate himself from the family altogether. He spoke only when words were dragged out of him, and even then he sounded as if he were talking to people he held in the utmost contempt. There had been three occasions on which he'd said rude, horrible things to Carmen that made her hurt just recalling them. And when he said them, he even looked different. His face tightened, became almost reptilian. She'd often wondered if perhaps this change in Stephen would have taken place had they not ignored what he'd said about the house, or if they had not moved into the house in the first place.
"Dinner tonight, Carmen."
She jerked upright, eyes wide, and turned to see Tanya standing before her, hands on her hips.
"What?" Carmen said. I'm sorry?
"I said, what are you planning for dinner tonight?"
I'm not sure, really."
She was nervous, fidgety, as if Tanya had been watching her thoughts unnoticed.
"How about you?"
"Oh, probably a frozen dinner. Benjamin won't be home from work until late tonight."
Carmen suggested that, instead of eating alone, Tanya and the baby should come over for dinner, providing they didn't mind something simple. Tanya agreed happily.
"You know," she said, "in all this time I think I've only been in your house once, and then for just a few minutes."
Carmen thought about it. She was right. She wondered how she'd gone so long without having Tanya over. After all, she spent a lot of time in Tanya's house. "Ashamed of your house, maybe?" her inner voice asked. "Afraid of what she might see or hear?" Carmen looked away from Tanya, blinking her eyes rapidly and quickly dismissed the thought. Carmen had already started dinner when the doorbell rang. Tanya held the baby in her arms as she entered, smiling. But her smile faltered a bit, and she frowned as she looked around her.
"Something smells good," she said,
her smile quickly recovering. Carmen noticed it, though she chose not to ask for an explanation.
"Pot roast, potatoes, and vegetables. Like I said, something simple. You want something to drink?"
Tanya had a beer, Carmen a diet soda, and the two of them sat at the dining room table, Tanya holding the baby, who was cooing contentedly, looking around with wide eyes in her lap.
"Where are the kids?" Tanya asked. "Outside. Except for Stephen, he's downstairs." "I thought he didn't like it downstairs."
"Not anymore. He's been spending a lot of time down there. He even mentioned something about moving back into his own room. I don't know, he seems..."
She shrugged, but didn't go on. Tanya was frowning again, looking off to her left as if she'd seen someone or something.
"What's wrong?"
Tanya blinked at her.
Nothing. I just thought I don't know. Maybe Al drove up. He should be here any time now."
Looking to the left again, Tanya murmured,
"No, I don't think..."
"Oh, well," she grinned at Carmen and said with forced cheerfulness, "can I help with dinner?"
"No, just relax."
They talked. As the conversation progressed, Tanya appeared more and more ill at ease, as if the chair she sat in were uncomfortable. Nervous tics came alive in her face, and her eyes darted around warily as she held the baby closer to her.
"Is something wrong, Tanya?"
Carmen asked quietly.
"What? No. I mean,
Her eyes darted around again. Then she smiled nervously.
"I'm sorry."
She looked down, sipped her beer, and kissed the baby's head.
"Sorry for what?"
Tanya didn't look up for a long moment. Then,
"Would you mind terribly if we didn't stay for dinner, Carmen?"
Carmen flinched.
"Well,
I thought, I'm really not that hungry, and I usually put her down pretty early, and,
she stood.
Could I have a rain check? Or how about if you and Al come over next weekend for a barbecue?
Carmen stood, too.
Wait a minute, Tanya. Hold it.
She followed Tanya into the hall. The skin at the back of her neck felt prickly, and she sensed that something was very wrong here.
There's something wrong. What is it?
Tanya would not meet Carmen's eyes as she reached for the doorknob.
Carmen, I'm...
She laughed again, a breathy staccato sound that rattled up from her throat. She opened the door a few inches, turned to Carmen timidly, and asked,
"Promise you won't laugh at me?" "Well, of course not, Tanya. What's the matter?" "It's just that I'm uncomfortable here." "What? What do you mean you're, it's this house. It's, there's something,
She shook her head and started out the door again. Carmen clutched her elbow a little harder than she intended and held on tight. Her heart was in a frenzy in her chest, even throbbing in her throat, and she was afraid to ask the question she needed to ask.
"What about this house, Tanya?"
Tanya replied after a long pause, whispering half her words.
"I'm not sure, but there's something, something wrong here. It's not just the house, it's the air. I feel it no matter what I do. It's like I'm trapped in a tiny room that just keeps getting smaller and smaller, you know? A claustrophobic feeling. But you've been here before and you never noticed any, only for a few minutes, never this long. I don't think I had time to see anything, and I didn't see anything. What did you see?"
Carmen's mouth was dry and chalky, and her palms were sweaty. She released Tanya's elbow and rubbed her hands over her hips to dry them.
"You didn't say anything about seeing anything."
Another edgy laugh.
"It's nothing, Carmen. Just what did you see?" "I'm not sure. I kept seeing, well, it looked like something was moving around in the hall, moving fast. Something small. I'm sure it was just me. It is, really. It's just me."
Another laugh.
"And I'm not going to be very good company, is all. Tell you what, I'll see you later, okay?"
She opened the door.
"Call me tonight. We'll make plans for this weekend, okay?"
She stepped out onto the porch.
"A barbecue. Our place. See you later."
Then she was hurrying across the lawn toward her own house. Carmen stood in the doorway for some time after Tanya left. Then she closed the door hard and leaned back against it, eyes closed. Thoughts raced through her mind, and she tried to slow them down. Maybe it was just all the things I'd told her about Stephen, about what he'd said, about what the kids claimed to have seen and heard, she thought. She smelled dinner, remembered she had a roast in the oven, and hurried into the kitchen to prepare the rest of the meal, trying to ignore the trembling of her hands. Al had been trying to ignore a lot of things, too. Like the music and voices coming from downstairs, for example. He'd heard them a number of times, enough times, in fact, so that he didn't even get out of bed anymore. Just lay awake, staring into the darkness, listening. Sometimes the bed vibrated, too. The way it had that first night. Of course, the family had moved in upstairs, Terence and Linda Van Owen, and their son and daughter, nice folks, friendly. So Al was able to use his upstairs refrigerator theory to dismiss the vibrating. It took some pushing, but he managed to convince himself, and a few extra beers before bed helped him to get to sleep in spite of the disturbing thoughts he tried to bury. Even when he slept as well as usual, however, Al found himself feeling as though he hadn't been, as if he'd been spending his nights tossing and turning between sweat-soaked sheets. He got through work with the help of a lot of coffee, and he started getting ready for bed as soon as he got home by opening his first bottle of beer. He lay in bed one night, awake, but with his eyes closed. He wondered if he was drinking too much beer, if maybe it could be behind the things he'd been hearing and feeling and thinking. Maybe, just maybe, Stephen had been right about the house. But then he told himself he'd been drinking more because of all those things, and he couldn't imagine himself not drinking. Not without going crazy. Not without blurting it all out to Carmen and, at the very least, looking crazy. After a while, with the steady and soothing sound of the alarm clock ticking on the nightstand, Al slept. He awoke suddenly and harshly,
to find himself shaking, and his first thought was, oh, God, it's shaking now, not vibrating, shaking. It was Carmen. She was clutching his shoulder, shaking him hard and hissing, Al, Al, wake up, Al, it's the bed, the bed.
What?
He sat up, squinting in spite of the darkness and blinking furiously, as if his eyes had something in them.
The bed, Al, the bed.
Once he'd emerged from the thick fog of sleep, he realized that it was happening again. The bed was vibrating. Its silent thrum moved through Al's body, wrapping around his bones like twine. He thought fast and came to a decision. If it worked for him, it would work for Carmen, too.
What's the matter with it?
He asked, trying not to look like he was in a hurry as he tossed back the covers and got out of bed. He stood there rubbing his eyes and running his fingers roughly through his hair.
You can't feel that?
Carmen said, speaking louder now. She stood on the other side of the bed in her long nightshirt with a picture of Opus the Penguin on the front.
It's vibrating is what's the matter with it. Feel it.
What?
Just feel it.
Al tried not to flinch as he put his hand on the bed and felt the familiar, somehow malignant, sensation ooze up the middle of his arm. After a moment, he pulled his hand away, nodded at Carmen, and said,
Yeah, well?
Well? Well? The bed is vibrating, Al. What is it? Why is it doing that?
It's from upstairs, he said quietly, calmly, his voice even and thick with the indifference of sleepiness.
From what?
From the refrigerator upstairs, that's all. It comes on and vibrates. Then comes down here and we feel it in the bed is all. Go back to sleep. It'll stop after a while. She stared at him, lips parted as he turned and headed for the bathroom. Once in the bathroom, Al turned on the light and locked the door. He didn't need to use it, but it was the only place he could think of to go in the middle of the night without having to give Carmen some sort of explanation. He put the toilet lid down and sat on it, elbows on his knees, his face in his palms, and exhaled slowly. He hoped the vibrating had stopped, and Carmen had gone back to sleep. He even prayed for it silently. After a while, he crossed himself, stood, and then stopped when he heard a loud noise from somewhere outside the house. The noise repeated again and again, stopped for a moment, then continued. Al frowned as he left the bathroom, muttering, Now what? It was a dog barking. He almost ignored it and went back into the bedroom, but it was so close, he thought he'd check it out. He went to the front window in the dining room, which seemed closest to the barking, and separated the blinds with two fingers. A bright moon cast a dull light over the ground like a luminescent bruise. A large dog stood at the edge of the front yard. In the poor light, it was difficult to tell what kind of dog, barking at the corner of the house. It was barking at the house the way a dog might bark to warn its master of an intruder, or the way a dog might bark at its own attacker. Vicious and rapid barks, punctuated by snarls and growls. He had never seen the dog before, and couldn't tell if it was wearing a collar or not. He didn't move for a while, just watched the dog as it barked persistently. He kept expecting it to stop and leave, but it didn't. If anything, its barks only became angrier and more threatening, more desperately fierce. Al felt a bead of sweat trickling down over his temple, and he moved the back of his free hand across his forehead. He was perspiring. His heart was pounding. This house, he thought. It's barking at the house because the house scares it. Pulling his hand away from the blinds, Al stepped back and just stood there, staring at the closed blinds a while as the dog barked and barked and barked. Secrets grew like tumors in the Snedeker household. Carmen did not tell Al when she heard someone laughing in the kitchen, although she was alone in the house. Al did not tell Carmen when he heard footsteps following him around the house one weekend, although no one was there. And Stephen only talked to them when he had to. When he was not at school, he spent most of his time in his room, often with Jason, who brought along tapes for them to listen to, the newest from the heaviest of metal bands, with lyrics that spoke only of sex and death, violence and suicide, torture and necrophilia. He didn't spend much time with Michael anymore, mostly because Michael wanted to do things, was interested in things that held no appeal for Stephen. As a result, Stephen was considering moving into the room that had originally been his. The idea of having a room of his own was, once again, appealing.
There would be nothing to interrupt the voices then. Late one night, Stephen lay awake in his bed listening to the sound of a dog barking outside. He'd heard it before, but had given it no thought until his dad complained about it one morning over breakfast before going to work. Al had said they needed to find out whose dog it was and call them. It had been sitting outside their house barking for several nights in a row. Curious, Stephen got out of bed and went upstairs, moving comfortably through the dark. He went to the window in the dining room and saw the dog outside in the moonlight, barking and snarling at the corner of the house. Nothing else. Not a squirrel. Not a cat. Just the house. Although he didn't realize it, one corner of Stephen's mouth curled up. So he wasn't entirely alone. The dog somehow knew the house held something unusual. The dog somehow knew it was occupied by something other than a mother and a father and four children. The dog knew. 12. Ghosts of Christmas Present. By Christmas time, Stephen had obtained a battered old leather jacket on the back of which he put a skull and crossbones, and the logo of some heavy metal group that combined an upside-down cross with a bloody dagger. He was wearing it one day when he came home from school. It was the last day of school before the beginning of Christmas vacation. Outside, everything was blanketed in snow, and Stephen brushed flakes off his scarf and jacket before coming through the front door. As he walked through the house, Carmen stopped him.
"Stephen, could you come here a second?"
she called from the dining room table. She wasn't looking forward to the talk she was about to have with him, about to try to have, because she had a pretty good idea how it was going to end up. Carmen and Al had talked with Stephen a lot lately, together and individually, about things ranging from the foul language he'd been using around the house to his personal hygiene, which, for reasons they could not understand, had gone steeply downhill over the past weeks. There were a lot of things they didn't understand about Stephen lately. Now there was the jacket. It was something he never would have considered wearing before their move. He'd always been a clean boy, a natty dresser, so polite and well-spoken. Not anymore.
"Sit down, Stephen,"
Carmen said quietly, smiling. With an annoyed sigh, he pulled out a chair and flopped into it, thumping his elbows onto the table, resting his chin on his fists. In spite of the fact that his cancer had gone into remission, Stephen still looked pale and thin, and although not as distinct, yellowish-gray half-circles still darkened the slightly puffy flesh beneath his eyes.
"Where did you get that jacket?"
Carmen asked.
"Somebody gave it to me."
"Leather jackets aren't cheap."
He shrugged.
"It's old. He didn't want it anymore. He gave it to me."
"Well, it's not a bad jacket, really. So why did you put that stuff on the back?"
Another shrug. A long, slow blink, then,
"'Cause I like it."
She leaned closer to him.
"Stephen, you know we don't want you wearing things like that."
"Like what?"
"That's the cross you've got on your back, and it's upside down."
"So?"
"Oh, don't play dumb with me, Stephen. You know what I'm talking about."
She was getting frustrated and angry already, and her voice was showing it.
"It's sacrilegious. And, well, if you ask me, you were the one talking about evil a few months ago, and, well, as far as I'm concerned, that's evil, what you've got on your back. We've given in with the music, so you pretty much get to listen to whatever crap you want to as long as you keep it to yourself, but that is too much."
"Well, what's the difference?" "I don't understand. It's part of the music. It's what the music stands for.
I know. That's why your dad and I don't like the music. That cross you're wearing on your back is a very important symbol. Christ died on that cross so we could..."
Stephen rolled his eyes.
Yeah, I know. I learned all about it in Sunday school."
"So how can you wear such a thing?"
"You're so worried about evil, so scared of it. But you've got it all around you and you don't see it. Just ignore it. I'm telling you, this house is evil."
"That again. Stephen, I don't understand you. I don't understand what's wrong with you."
Then Stephen did something that made Carmen drop her mouth open and gasp, shocked and hurt. He laughed, shook his head and said,
"You don't understand much of anything, do you?"
He stood from the table and went to his room, leaving Carmen staring at the place where he'd sat, her mouth still open, her wide eyes full of pain. Finally, she lit a cigarette and exhaled warily. Her next step, of course, would be to talk to Al about it, but she wasn't too eager to do that either. Al seemed very short-tempered lately, especially where Stephen was concerned. He had no tolerance for the changes that had taken place in the boy. Carmen had to admit she felt much the same way, but at least tried to be fair and civil about it, tried her best to see Stephen's side, something that was getting more difficult all the time, since he seemed so unwilling to share his side. She was afraid that sooner or later she would tell Al about something Stephen had done or was doing, and Al would lose whatever restraint he'd been showing and come down on the boy hard, really hard, with something besides the usual grounding or suspension of telephone privileges, like harsh physical punishment, for example. Although she understood the desire to do that, Stephen had pushed her tolerance to the edge too, especially with his response to her complaint about the jacket. The thought of it made her cringe. But the back of Stephen's jacket made her cringe as well. She would talk to Al. If he did no good, she would have to take stronger measures. Although she waited until after dinner that night, hoping he would be relaxed, Al was furious. He went downstairs and, from the living room, Carmen could hear him shouting at Stephen. She even heard what sounded like something being thrown against the wall. Peter was dozing on the sofa beside her. Stephanie and Michael were on the floor watching television, their backs stiff, their eyes fixed on the screen as they fought to ignore the sounds. Then, after a brief silence, she heard Al's footsteps thumping up the stairs and his voice barking angrily. "That's it! I give up! You want to go around looking like some kind of satanic punk? That's fine. Just don't tell anybody you live here. Spoiled little shit is what you are. Don't know where it comes from, but it doesn't come from us." As he came down the hall, his tirade continued. Carmen could hear the faint sound of Stephen's laughter from downstairs. She hurried into the hall to meet Al. "I don't know what the hell to do with him," he growled, going into the kitchen and getting a beer from the refrigerator. "He wants to keep his fucking jacket. Al," she chided, wincing, "he can keep it. I don't give a damn. Wants to go around looking like a thug, like a damned criminal or some kind of, I don't know, some kind of cult member? Then fine." He leaned back against the edge of the counter and tilted his head back as he drank.
"Well, there's something wrong. I just don't know what."
"He's a goddamn spoiled brat is what's wrong."
What, it's my fault? Is that what you're saying? It's my fault he's behaving this way?"
"Hey." He spread his arms and raised his eyebrows. "You said that, not me." Carmen spun around, stretched out her arm and leaned against the refrigerator with her elbow locked. She closed her eyes a moment, lips pressed together tightly. She knew this could turn into an ugly argument if she pursued that thinly veiled accusation any further. She decided against it, took a deep breath, and turned around.
"I think I should take him to see Father Wheatley."
Al took another slug of beer and sighed. "You think it'd do any good?"
"Couldn't hurt, could it?"
He thought about it a moment, frowned, became rather distant. Then he said quietly, as if to himself, "It's just been since we moved here, into this house." Carmen was surprised by his words. Could he possibly be entertaining some of the same thoughts that had haunted her? But hid her surprise quickly.
"You think that has something to do with it?" she asked.
"Hmm? Oh, no, of course not. Just an observation is all. He's changed a lot in a little time."
"That's why I think he should talk to Father Wheatley."
"Yeah. Yeah. It couldn't hurt." She called Father Wheatley the next day and explained the problem, and he agreed to see Stephen. Against his protests, Carmen took Stephen to the church and dropped him off while she went to the grocery store. When she was finished shopping, she returned, picked him up, and headed home, resisting the urge to go inside and ask Father Wheatley how it went and what was wrong with her son. Instead, she tried to start a conversation with Stephen.
"So, what did you and the father talk about?" she asked.
Looking out the side window, he shrugged.
"I don't know. Not much. Just talked, I guess."
And that was the most she could get out of him. She could only hope and pray that Father Wheatley would be able to do some good, But that was not enough for her. When she got home, she called Father Wheatley on the bedroom telephone.
"How did it go, Father?"
she asked.
"Well, Carmen, if you don't mind, I'd rather not talk about it in any detail. I will say this much, though. You did the right thing in bringing him to see me. I'd like to see him again. Tomorrow, in fact, if that's okay."
"Of course it's okay. I'm so glad. I mean, I was worried that, well, Al and I were both worried that..."
She didn't finish, afraid that her voice would break and tears would start.
"Listen, Carmen," Father Wheatley said softly. "I'm here for you, too. I think Stephen needs these talks right now, and I suspect we might make some progress. But if you need someone to talk to, don't hesitate."
"Thank you, Father,"
she whispered.
"Same time tomorrow?"
"Same time."
But Carmen was not able to drive Stephen to see Father Wheatley the next day. That evening, Carmen received a call from her brother Everett in Alabama. The instant she heard his voice at the other end of the line, she became tense. He only called her when he needed something, or when something was wrong. Like their father, he was an alcoholic who had no intention of treating his problem. Carmen's heart went out to him, and he was always in her prayers, but she'd finally realized a number of years ago that there was only so much she could do for him, and if he was ever going to be saved, he was going to have to take the first step himself.
"Carmen, you're gonna have to come home. Right away."
His voice was wet and quavery.
"What's wrong, Everett?"
"Dad, he's dead, Carmen. Somebody killed him. He's been murdered. You gotta come."
Carmen was stunned into cold silence for a while. When she could speak again, she told Everett it was snowing in Connecticut, but she would catch the next available plane and be there as soon as possible. After she'd hung up, she plopped onto the sofa and stared at nothing as she thought about her father. Her parents had divorced when she was 12, and she'd never been close to her father, had hardly known him, really, unlike her brother, who had remained in constant touch with him. In spite of that fact, Everett had always held their father's lifestyle in contempt. His constant drinking, his lack of care for himself, his hand-to-mouth life on the edge, but not enough, apparently, to keep himself from following the same pattern. The presence of that pattern in her family kept Carmen from touching alcohol, and was responsible for the gnawing concern she had about Al's attachment to beer, something she had not yet found the courage to mention to him. She called the airport. Carmen was able to find a plane leaving that evening. Al had to scramble to make arrangements at work so he would be able to take care of the kids while Carmen was gone. He cringed at the thought of doing such a thing so soon after starting at the quarry, but it was one of those unpredictable and unavoidable crises that happened to everyone from time to time, and his boss would just have to work it out. After driving Carmen to the airport, Al and Stephanie and Peter picked up a pizza on their way home. Al had never been able to cook and had no intention of trying now, so until Carmen returned, they'd live on takeout and frozen dinners. That night, once the pizza was gone, Stephen retreated, as usual, to his room. He'd spent most of the evening there anyway, taking his dinner downstairs with him. Tension was growing between Al and Stephen. The room was quieter when they were together, the air somehow thicker. They spoke to one another only when necessary, which was slowly becoming less often as time passed. That was fine with Al. He didn't care to have much to do with the boy until he cleaned up his act. Maybe that was harsh, but it was the best he knew how to do. There was no reason for Stephen's recent behavior, and to act as if nothing was wrong seemed no different to Al than telling him it was okay. Al and Michael watched a football game on television, while Stephanie and Peter did some pasting and coloring at the dining room table. There was no school tomorrow, so Al wasn't concerned with how late they stayed up. But they had grown used to going to bed early, and it wasn't long before they were all sleepy enough to retire to their rooms. Al was left alone after the game, watching sitcom reruns, and thinking. He didn't look forward to going to bed. Not alone. Alone, he might just lie awake, waiting for the music, The voices? The vibrating. 3 hours later, his eyes were heavy and his head kept drooping forward as he watched television. Finally, he gave in, turned off the television and the lights, and went to bed. Once beneath the covers, his weariness vanished and, just as he'd suspected he would do, he lay awake, twisting and turning to find a comfortable spot, a soothing position. He did, eventually. His eyes closed on their own. He felt the heaviness of sleep wash over him, was aware of his breathing becoming slow, felt himself slipping away, until he heard music, and his eyes snapped open. He sat up. It was the same music he always heard, old and tinny, conjuring black and white images of rooms full of cobwebs, old photographs and ornate frames and antique furniture. Al lay back down, pressing the heels of his palms into his eyes, and